Trump keeps America safe from COVID-19 by threatening to shoot down Iranian gunboats while failing to address the question, is Kim Jong ill? This week, a lot of soul searching on The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. Has the coronavirus made Joe Biden's VP pick more complicated?
To give Biden the ability to really break through and use this process to actually communicate a message in terms of not only how he would govern, but how he would handle the potential issue of being the president in the era of COVID-19.
Plus, remember back when there was politics and baseball? There's a long history of the combination of the two.
General George Washington at Valley Forge played baseball, that is, rounders, which was a British antecedent of the game, Abraham Lincoln. There are many records of him playing town ball, a derivative of baseball.
And we go back 20 years to the raid in Miami that reunited Elian Gonzalez with his father. Did Al Gore pay a political price?
He only ended up with 18% of the Cuban vote when Clinton had gotten 35% the year before. And you can almost point exactly when it was that his numbers started to depress. It was right after Elian Gonzalez.
It's all coming up on The Political Junkie, which starts right now.
You like Ike, I like Ike, everybody likes Ike
for president.
And Ike to you, and Ike to me, I don't care how you quote it.
Come on and vote for Kennedy, vote for Kennedy, and we'll come out on top.
Vote for Richard Nixon and Henry Cabot Lodge, cause they're the ones to lead the USA.
Thanks for joining us, and welcome to episode 325 of The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. The anger, resentment, and frustration over a stay-at-home America is understandable. But it's also becoming partisan, like everything else in this country, and that is regrettable. Republican governors are talking about reopening up their states well before a sufficient number of testing has been conducted. Protesters carrying pro-Trump signs and wearing MAGA hats are demonstrating against mostly Democratic governors, holding rallies without wearing masks and clearly within 6 feet of each other. The NRA is saying this is all a pretext for the confiscation of your guns. And the President of the United States is encouraging it all.
You mentioned the importance of social distancing, but for example, Stephen Moore, someone you appointed to your Open the Country task force, is organizing a protest in Wisconsin, but aren't they, in a sense, protesting your very own guidelines?
Well, we have a flexibility. I didn't see what Stephen said. I can tell you he's a very good economist. He's been calling shots right.
He said we need to be the Rosa Parks of government injustices.
Well, there is a lot of injustice. When you look at Virginia, where they want to take your guns away, if they want to violate your Second Amendment, when you look at, I mean, look, I'm getting along very nicely with the governor of Michigan, but she has things, don't buy paint, don't buy roses, don't buy, I mean, she's got all these crazy things. Some of them are being unreasonable. I really believe that they're being unreasonable. But I think Virginia is a great case, though, because they're using this. They're trying to take your guns away in Virginia. And if people in Virginia aren't careful, that's what's going to happen to them.
And the president has a new target, China. After months of offering praise,
I spoke with President Xi. We had a great talk. He's working very hard, I have to say. He's working very, very hard. And if you can count on the reports coming out of China, that spread has gone down quite a bit.
He is now blaming China and President Xi for their role in spreading the virus worldwide.
All I can say is wherever it came from China, in whatever form, 184 countries now are suffering because of it. And it's too bad, isn't it? And it could have been solved very easily. When it was just starting, it could have been solved really very easily. We have a lot of discussions going on with China. Let me just put it this way. I'm not happy, okay? I'm not happy.
And while we're at it, Joe Biden is to blame as well. A Trump ad calls the former vice president dangerous for America. The Biden campaign responded with this.
Look around. 22 million Americans are out of work, and we have more officially reported cases and deaths than any other country. Donald Trump left this country unprepared and the worst public health and economic crisis in our lifetime. And now we're paying the price. All the negative ads in the world can't change the truth.
And that, ladies and gentlemen, is where we are today.
You can see yourself now, baby. It's not my fault. You used to be so in control. You're going to roll right over this one. Just roll.
The only suspense left in Joe Biden's climb to the Democratic presidential nomination is the naming of a running mate. He said the process is going to begin by mid-April, and, well, we've already passed mid-April. So the only thing we know for certain is that it will be a she.
If I'm elected president, my cabinet, my administration will look like the country. And I commit that I will, in fact, pick a woman to be vice president. There are a number of women who are qualified to be president tomorrow. I would pick a woman to be my vice president.
That was from the first and only Biden-Bernie debate back on March 15th. Since then, there has been no shortage of predictions of who it, she, might be. Kamala Harris, Amy Klobuchar, Elizabeth Warren, Stacey Abrams, Gretchen Whitmer, Val Demings. We always spend so much time speculating on the vice presidential choice, only to say, ultimately, that it doesn't really matter much. Remember all the excitement in 1984 when Walter Mondale named Geraldine Ferraro the first woman ever to be named on a major party ticket? Goosebumps everywhere, people in tears at the convention in San Francisco. And the Mondale-Ferraro ticket lost 49 out of 50 states that year to Reagan and Bush. Remember all the criticism in 1988 when George Bush named Dan Quayle as his running mate? What a joke, the critics said. He's out of his depth, they argued. He got squashed by Lloyd Benson in their VP debate, said the conventional wisdom of the day. But the Bush-Quayle ticket carried 40 out of 50 states to Dukakis and Benson. But this time it feels like it matters. Joe Biden is 77 years old. He'll turn 78 a few weeks after the election. Actuarial tables alone suggest that his choice of a running mate could be very significant, someone who could be the future leader of the party. These are the kind of questions Chris Lehane dealt with back in 2000 when he was the press secretary for Al Gore's presidential campaign. He also worked for the Bill Clinton campaigns of 1992 and 1996 and served as an attorney in the White House counsel's office during the Monica Lewinsky scandal. He also worked on the presidential effort of Wes Clark in 2004 and is considered one of the Democratic Party's top operatives in opposition research. He is currently the head of global policy and public affairs for Airbnb. Chris Lehane, welcome to The Political Junkie.
Ken, thanks. It's an honor to be here. And I sort of feel like I'm dealing with the political world's institutional memory when I'm talking to you. So it's great to be here.
I appreciate it. I love that you're here. Well, you know, you've heard all the criteria for what Joe Biden should be looking for in a running mate. And, you know, we hear pretty much the same thing every 4 years. Are these people prepared to become president? Can they win a battleground state? Do they balance the ticket, you know, regarding ideology or geography or add to what the presidential nominee might be lacking? Is there a comfort zone? Is there a comfort zone, some personal chemistry between the two? And, you know, as I said, these are all familiar things. We talk about every presidential cycle, but somehow, either because of Biden's age or the situation the nation finds itself in, this feels different.
Yeah, I do agree with you that it's different. I also think, and again, this is stuff that you know so well, if you look at, you know, the evolution of the vice presidential selection process, you know, it has gone through different chapters, right? There was a time called the pre-electronic age or the pre-modern age of campaigns, you know, when the vice president, the job itself was not held in particularly high esteem, but the selection process was part of the convention process, right? And it really dealt with internal politics within a party. Then you've got, you know, into the post-World War II era, and I think probably you can look at a 1960 election when JFK picks LBJ, which helps bring Texas, right? So this idea that it could really bring a state. I think of the 1992 race when Bill Clinton picked Al Gore, and that wasn't about balancing the ticket from a geographical perspective or necessarily bringing a state. It was about reinforcing the message, right? Generational change.
And they were very similar. They had a comfort level between the two of them.
That's right. And look, I certainly agree with the threshold question in all of this, which is, are you comfortable with the person? Do you have a threshold relationship with them? Do they pass the test of whether they can be a heartbeat away from the president? I think that's first and foremost. And I think that has generally been the case over the last couple cycles, and people can screw this up by making a decision that does not suggest that you made a good first presidential decision, if you may. But I do think this period is going to be the next evolution or iteration in terms of how vice presidential selection processes work.
Most importantly, and I think what hits everybody in the gut, is that there's no escaping the fact that Biden will be 78 in November.
And has intimated at times that, you know, whether he would serve more than one term, right? I mean, it's been suggested more or less. I also think you're in a time period where people are really concerned about who's going to be comprising and constituting government. Are there going to be people who have the capacity, skill set, ability to take on significant roles given what is going on in the world right now? And I think the third piece of this, which to me is really important, and you know, this goes back to the times when I was involved with this stuff, is the actual selection process itself, right? It always takes on importance because it is supposed to speak to that first presidential level decision that a candidate is making, i.e. the nominee. But the process itself can be used to really not just occupy a lot of what we traditionally called media real estate, right? The whole process can take, you know, weeks, and it generates a lot of attention, can be used to generate momentum. I think in this particular time period, the process itself is going to be probably more important than it ever has been to give Biden the ability to really break through and use this process to actually communicate a message in terms of not only how he would govern, but how he would handle the potential issue of being the president in the era of COVID-19. So I think the process itself represents a huge opportunity for the campaign. And just given that we're in a time period when people really are looking to government for answers and big ideas, this is his first presidential level decision as the nominee to be president. And this decision will say an awful lot about him and how he's going to govern. It's going to be more important probably than ever, at least in the modern era.
You mentioned your role in 2000, and I'd love to know, I'd love to know what the Gore team was considering when they wound up picking Joe Lieberman in 2000.
I am humbled by this nomination and so grateful to Al Gore for choosing me.
I remember that time period really, really well. And, you know, this is 2000, so it was a while ago.
Chris, it was yesterday.
Okay, it was yesterday. But we really did try to create a really defined process with specific markers to do a couple things. One, to be able to control and drive the narrative as much as possible, to really reinforce that the VP was approaching this with a level of importance, because there was an understanding that this would reflect how he would make decisions, you know, as president. And then obviously to be able to try to occupy as much of the media coverage as possible. And so, you know, we worked backwards over about a 6 or 8 week time period. We initially put out a relatively large group of folks who were being considered. Well, first of all, we announced a group of people who would be supporting the campaign in that process, led by the late, great former Secretary of State Warren Christopher, also supported by Ron Klain, who had been Al Gore's chief of staff as vice president in the White House, obviously later went on to other great government positions.
And he's part of the vetting process with Joe Biden, too, right?
And he's part of the vetting. Yeah, I mean, Ron is like your go-to person to run a good VP process and to run a good debate process, and also to deal with pandemics, as we have seen. In any case, we established that there was going to be this group of men and women of impeccable credentials who would help direct the process. We then put out literally a calendar of how we saw the process going, announced a large group of names. And then it was almost like, and I remember I compared this internally to the March Madness NCAA basketball tournament, right? Where every week you basically winnowed down the field. But each week, right, you were doing interviews, you were doing meetings, you were going to the state, you were doing events, rallies, almost as if, you know, people, well, not almost, in fact, were, you know, auditioning for the job. But really, to be able to really tell that story over what I think was about a six-week period, you know, ending with what effectively was a Final Four, you know, that included, obviously, Senator Lieberman, Senator John Edwards, then from North Carolina, Senator Bob Graham from Florida. There was a small group that was really Senator Kerry from Massachusetts. There was a small group that really ended up there at the end, and then really programming the announcement, you know, on, I believe it was a Monday morning, although I don't specifically remember the day, but I do remember it was a morning to really sort of lead the news cycle.
Was Evan Bayh on that list?
Evan Bayh was in there. Yeah, you're right. There, I'm trying to remember from the various folks. And I do remember the call going to Joe Lieberman and telling him that he should turn on, I believe it was CNN, and then correspondent Claire Shipman before she moved, I believe, to NBC. But she may have been at ABC. I forget. She was at one of the networks. And we had given her the exclusive on it time to a Wire story. And remember calling and saying, you should turn on, I think it was ABC, you should turn on the show that Claire is on and watch it. And he literally learned it at the same time that it was being broken on the Wire, I think with Ron Fournier from the AP and Claire with her morning program, and then just rolled it out over the course of the day.
Gore didn't call him? He Lieberman found out by watching television?
We actually had, the way it worked was Gore actually put the call in, but the network had been teed off to where they should have cameras. And so they had cameras literally outside of a couple of these potential folks' homes, but actually see into the Lieberman window, you know, as the call came in from Gore. You know, they didn't know specifically who it was, although obviously Ron and Claire did, because we wanted to give them time to work up their story.
Now, I know there were many John Kerry advisors today who regret the choice of John Edwards, obviously, given all that's come out after that. But were Gore and your team happy with the Lieberman pick? I mean, it's pretty much united behind that decision?
Yeah, I mean,
The only reason I think of that is because I always felt that Gore wasn't exactly sure how to deal with Bill Clinton's negatives in 2000, and maybe Lieberman was his way of saying he wanted to separate himself a little bit from the president.
It's a great question, and I'll share a little bit. I think, you know, first and foremost, I think there was a real rapport between the two of them, and that was incredibly important for Gore. I mean, really, his first two criteria for this pick, number one, is this someone that he would feel comfortable being able to do the job? I mean, that was clear throughout. And then secondly, did he feel that this was someone that he had a personal connection with when they would do their weekly lunch? Could he really have a real conversation? The presidency is an incredibly lonely position. There's very few people you can really have those types of conversations with that allow you to noodle through and think through issues and bounce ideas off of. And I think at some level that reflected his experience as the number two. And so coming up from that perspective, I think once you got, you know, beyond those two things, and they were by far and away the most important, I think there are other folks, you know, who are offering different perspectives. You know, I certainly was one who believed that Bob Graham would have been a great pick because I just thought he brings Florida. And in a race that you could even tell at that point was going to come down to a few handful of states, being able to potentially identify someone who could put Florida into your column, I just thought was pretty significant. And I also thought he checked off the other boxes. I do think that there were certainly those in the campaign who viewed Senator Lieberman, who was a person of unquestioned, you know, character, as a real validation in terms of just the nature of the ticket at a time when there were questions, at least from some quarters, as to how the vice president was going to really distinguish and differentiate himself from the sitting president at that time, President Clinton. Now, in my view, that's always a dynamic that every vice president who is seeking to be the nominee goes through. They do have to go through that process of distinguishing and differentiating. Obviously, there was a lot going on in that particular time period with character being a big focal point of the conversation. But I really think at the end of the day, for Gore, it was really those first two, which is, here is someone that I really believe could step in if needed, and someone I just feel personally close to and comfortable with.
So, you know, I think, I mean, I've seen so far it gives some governors an opportunity to shine, like Andrew Cuomo. I think you used to work for him, right?
Yes, I was his counsel at HUD and helped with his nomination process, and I'm a huge fan.
Yeah, he stood out with his COVID-19 updates, But look, Joe Biden is not going to go back on his "I'm picking a woman" pledge. So, but then there's Gretchen Whitmer, who's on the firing line in Michigan to basically shut down her state, and she has an opportunity to shine as well.
Yeah, I think that in some regards, right, you can't do the historic auditions that you would have done in the past, where you go into a rally or you see someone out there serving as a surrogate on your behalf. I mean, there was a whole arc to how potential vice presidential candidates to be picked to be the vice president would go about auditioning for this process. A lot of those opportunities do not exist right now. But what clearly does exist is the fact that, you know, people are actually having to demonstrate their mettle, their capacity, really their ability to step in and assume the number one position if called upon because of the nature of COVID-19. And so I do think you see, in particular, governors being put in a position where they are having to show the types of leaders they are under incredible pressure. And so I do think you have had any number of governors who have emerged in this process. They're not doing this because they're auditioning to be vice president. They're doing this because of the nature of the crisis. But I think a consequence of this is it's allowing certain people to really emerge and demonstrate, do they have that proverbial what it takes?
You know, earlier we were talking about, you know, picking people because they would help win a state or a region. And you mentioned JFK and LBJ. But clearly, I mean, going back to more recent history, George W. Bush didn't pick Dick Cheney in order to carry Wyoming. And Barack Obama didn't choose Biden so he could win Delaware's 3 electoral votes. Bush needed Cheney's foreign policy experience, and Obama needed Biden's decades of service in Washington. So they both, my point is, they both picked guys who filled in the gaps of their own record.
They balanced the ticket in a different way. There was a different way of balancing the ticket, not geographically, but maybe in terms of depth or in terms of policy expertise.
And you talk about, you know, personal chemistry, and you talk about that Clinton and Gore had it. And then I think of Bob Dole picking Jack Kemp in 1996. They hated each other.
They hated each other before they were picked.
Exactly.
I mean, going back to the 1986 tax bill, right? I mean, there was a whole history there with just, not only did they not balance the ticket, they actually had a philosophical difference on some core fiscal issues.
Right. You also mentioned that it would have been nice to if Gore had picked Bob Graham in Florida, given the importance Florida turned out to be. And people say this, they said this in 2004. They said it last time that the Midwest is a critical background. So in other words, what if Kerry had picked Dick Gephardt in 2004? What if Hillary Clinton settled on Sherrod Brown last time? I mean, again, I don't want to overdo the importance of the VP, but in a close election, a state or two could make a difference.
Up until this particular issue, and I'll come back to this in a second, I am aligned with you. I actually think that, you know, over time, people had moved away from the import of a VP being able to help you carry a state, because I think they were beginning to value other ways that the ticket could potentially be balanced, obviously the personal relationship. But I think over time, people had sort of lost sight of the fact that in elections, and the last several elections have been like this, right? They've come down to literally 3 or 4 states, if not even a smaller subset. And the ability to pick someone who can actually help you carry a state, just to me, in the current electoral context, just took on a lot more importance. And I really do believe that, and look, it's really easy to say this in retrospect, and I'm not trying to Monday morning quarterback this, but, you know, Bob Graham on the ticket in 2000, Gore wins Florida by more margin than he actually did win Florida by. Talk about a sliding doors moment, right, in terms of everything that plays out. And so that brings us to today. I do think that people are going to be looking at this pick, not from a perspective of are they, you know, giving you a policy balance, but really from the perspective of, is this someone who's going to be able to contribute in a material, meaningful way for our federal government to be able to take on the issues that we currently face?
Chris Lahane was the press secretary for Al Gore's presidential campaign in 2000. Prior to that, he worked in the Clinton White House, and he's currently the head of global policy and public affairs for Airbnb. Chris, it was great having you on the show.
Ken, it was, it's always fun to talk to you. And as I said, I feel like I'm talking to one of the great institutional memories out there when it comes to politics in America. So it's awesome. Thanks for having me.
Well, I appreciate that. And pretty soon I'm going to be in an institution. I could just feel it after this campaign. Thanks, Chris.
Okay, thank you. Good to hear your voice. We got to get you.
There are many things we miss during this new world order of a pandemic. Baseball. And presidents who loved baseball. It's hard to tell when either will return. But there's always been a strong connection between baseball and politics. Sometimes it's hard to tell them apart, with their similar focus on history and stats and trivia. Oftentimes, politicians themselves talk about it. Here's Bobby Kennedy, the night he won the California primary in June of 1968. This was the first thing he said, which may not have been totally serious, but it was certainly unexpected.
I want to express my high regard to Don Drysdale. Pitched his sixth straight shutout tonight. And I hope that we have his good fortune in our campaign.
But ever since William Howard Taft threw out the first ceremonial pitch on opening day 1910, there's been a steady link between presidents and baseball. Perhaps the most memorable first pitch came not on an opening day, but during Game 3 of the 2001 World Series, held at Yankee Stadium in the Bronx. Just 6 weeks after the attacks of 9/11. The pitch came from President George W. Bush, wearing a bulletproof Fire Department of New York jacket. Here's the veteran Yankees public address announcer, the late Bob Shepard.
For tonight's ceremonial first pitch, and please welcome the President of the United States.
Bush threw a perfect strike to the catcher.
Thank you, Mr. President.
Bush's memorable visit to Yankee Stadium is just one of the fabulous stories Kurt Smith writes about in his book, The Presidents and the Pastime, The History of Baseball and the White House. He's a former Bush speechwriter as well as a baseball historian, and the combination works perfectly in the book. I spoke to Kurt 2 years ago, and I'm missing baseball so much right now that I decided to repeat the interview.
I, too, share a great love of what I call America's twinning of the heart, these great two American institutions, the national office, the presidency, the national game, baseball. And, boy, what a pleasure it was researching and writing this book, because both have meant so much to me and I know to you. Since quite literally it is the earliest days of my life. And if you can repay even slightly what they have meant to both of us, I'm all for that.
Well, I should let the listeners know that just prior to us recording this interview, you and I had maybe a 15-minute conversation about baseball and politics. And, oh, my goodness, this book covers my two passions. I just wonder who might like this more, political junkies or baseball junkies?
Well, I don't know. You know, that's part of the charm. You can argue this at a bar, and many have, and probably many will. But that's part of the great allure. I think of two great communicators, two fascinating intellectuals, if you will, Mario Cuomo and Richard Nixon. Both loved politics. Both loved baseball particularly. Cuomo played baseball in the Pittsburgh Pirates farm system as a pitcher before becoming injured and going to law school. And they both became friends in the last 10 years of Nixon's life. And they often talked about the similarities between the two. And if I could briefly summarize that they were both competitive. They both demanded that you marshal all of the resources that you have. That would be mental and physical, often moral, spiritual, all that you have to offer during a long campaign or let's say the marathon of a baseball season, they were clear cut. You knew at the end of an election or at the end of a baseball game who had won and lost and why, and they both involved strategy, or as Bush 43 would say, strategy. And they both were not exactly bereft of ego, if I may try to put it in the most gentle vein. And they were both consumed by these as well, Nixon and Cuomo.
Although I don't remember Cuomo calling the coach of a Super Bowl team, calling it a play, right, as Nixon did with George Allen and the Redskins.
That's very true. But Allen had been the football coach at Whittier College, which was Nixon's alma mater, so perhaps that was one qualifying factor as well. But, they were both lifelong baseball fans and true connoisseurs of the sport.
When I think of presidents in baseball, I think everybody knows that William Howard Taft threw out the ceremonial first pitch. But were presidents involved in the game before then?
Well, they were to an extent. Washington, before there was a presidency, he was General George Washington, at Valley Forge, played baseball, that is, rounders, which was a British antecedent of the game, with an aide-de-camp for hours, strategizing in his own mind about where the war would go from there. You go to the early 1860s, Abraham Lincoln. There are many records of and episodes in the book of him playing town ball, a derivative of baseball, on the South Lot, as it was then called. We call it the Ellipse, where the National Christmas Tree is. And he would play town ball outside for hours. He would bring the game inside the White House, if you can imagine, and use the corridors for base paths. And there are accounts of Lincoln, all 6 foot 4 inches of him, flying down the corridor. I don't think he was necessarily timed from home plate to first base because the game wasn't exactly formalized at that point. But the point of a larger sense is how deeply rooted baseball is in the nation's past.
But when you think of playing baseball in the White House, I mean, wasn't Nixon caught stealing? Okay, I'm sorry.
Well,
that was so cheap.
That depends. Depends on your affiliation.
Right. Well, you know something? You mentioned Washington, and this is in your book, and I've read this before, but I love this so much. In Henry Lee's eulogy of President Washington, he said, first in war, first in peace, and first in the hearts of his countrymen, right? So tell me about what they said about the Washington Senators.
Oh, well, of course, it's one of the great adages in sports history. First in war, first in peace, and last in the American League. And as Dizzy Dean would say, Podnai, you ain't just a woofin'. They earn last place on merit. To an extent, as I say in the book, that the late great announcer Bob Wolf, who did the Senators from 1946 and 60, used to tell me tongue-in-cheek, I think he was kidding, that whenever he was broadcasting the Senators, he would simply, during the course of a baseball game, people tuning in from time to time, would just hear him give the score, 10 to 2, 6 to 4, 13 to 1. He wouldn't necessarily at all say who was ahead. He said people tuning in knew who was winning, and it wasn't the Senators. That's how bad the Senators were.
Well, if you look at the fights between Mitch McConnell and Chuck Schumer, the Senators are not doing so well this time either. Listen, I know that George Bush Sr., you know, president number 41.
Yes.
He played baseball at Yale in the 1940s. He was the team captain. Is there a president who is considered, whom you consider to be the best baseball player of all the presidents?
Well, I'm biased a tad, except I hope valiantly and successfully in this book to be dispassionate, bipartisan, nonpartisan. The reader will decide. But, of course, I worked for Bush 41 for the entirety of his term from 1989 through 93 and then headed his speech staff for the following 4 years. He's a marvelous human being, as the country knows by now. And he told me that... I once asked him why he loved baseball, and he paused for a moment and he said, baseball has everything, which Ken's a wonderfully succinct three-word inscription of baseball's allure. And I asked him when he first came to this grasp, and he said, oh, the first time I ever swung a wooden baseball bat. And I said, when was that? He said, oh, when I turned five. He's now 94. about to turn 94, and still in love with the game. And he's played it, he's coached it. Barbara Bush is his late wife, carpooled kids to baseball games, Bush said, all over the state of Texas, slight hyperbole. And I know from talking to Bush dozens of times about baseball over the years that it was deeply embedded in the Bush family. But to your question, yes, I think he is definitely the best baseball player, the best athlete ever to become president. This is a man who came back from World War II, became captain of his baseball team at Yale, was a stunning fielder. And the statistics support me on this, which I cite in the book. He couldn't hit a lick, as he freely admitted. But then that's a problem that thwarted many of us, including yours truly. But there is footage of him, video, in his 60s, making spectacular stops behind sprawling behind first base, getting up, racing to the bag ahead of the runner. So he kept himself in great shape and has. But yes, he was a marvelous fielder. And a scout told me, Major League scout, that had there been a position called designated fielder at the time, along with designated hitter, that Bush easily would have made the bigs as a designated fielder. He was a marvelous baseball player.
You know, on the cover of your book, we see President Franklin Roosevelt standing up and throwing out a ball.
Yeah.
Was there a reason you picked FDR for the cover?
How could I not? He was the spine of the book, quite literally. This is a man who saved the game. That is not hyperbolic. It's based upon fact. He, of course, served from 1933 through his death in 1945. He helped us win the war. He helped save the world. That, too, is not hyperbolic. He also saved baseball. When the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor on December 7th, 1941, baseball typically was clueless. It didn't know whether it should operate in 1942. And by baseball, I mean organized baseball, the majors and also the minor leagues. Didn't know whether it should operate in 42 or indeed during at any time during the remaining duration of the war, no matter how long that would be until hopefully total victory. So Kennesaw Mountain Landis, the commissioner, wrote a letter to Roosevelt saying, in essence, we are at your mercy. Tell us what to do. The next day, January 15th, 1942, Roosevelt sent a letter to Landis. Moreover, Ken, this shows the stunning importance of baseball then to the United States of America. Franklin D. Roosevelt read the entirety of his letter to the Commissioner of Baseball at his White House press conference. And what he said was this, not simply that I hope baseball will play. He, in essence, instructed baseball to play for the duration of the war. He said it's important to the morale of the home front, and he said that next to letters from loved ones here at home, what would improve the morale of troops abroad more than anything would be box scores and game accounts in newspapers from home. Bingo. Franklin Roosevelt knew his country, and he knew his game. He saved baseball. And in fact, I catalog in the chapter on Franklin Roosevelt. Every president has a chapter on him, beginning with Theodore Roosevelt, going through Donald Trump. And in the Roosevelt chapter, I catalog how he saved the game, how people at the time understood that he saved the game, and why Franklin Roosevelt deserves to be inducted posthumously by the National Baseball Hall of Fame and Museum in Cooperstown. There are nearly 300 plaques of players and executives who have been inducted at Cooperstown. Not one of them, Ken, merits the phrase or has a phrase on his plaque, saved baseball. Franklin Roosevelt saved baseball.
What is it, do you think, about presidents and baseball that we don't find with other sports like basketball or football?
Well, it's a game of individual, for one, and it's a game of history for the other. I think it's almost impossible for someone to be elected president without understanding the gravity of the office, without understanding the consequences that rest upon him, and without being interested and transfixed, frankly, by predecessors. What decisions did they make? What were they faced with? How did they confront this crisis or that? And this lends itself naturally to favoring baseball over other sports. I mean, the history of baseball in this country, I would suggest, dwarfs all other sports combined. So if you're president, how could you not be impressed by that?
As a Yankees fan, I know I get booze about that a lot, but as a Yankees fan...
Well, it's a Red Sox fan.
Oh, I'm sorry, I just accidentally hung up on you. I'm so sorry. No, never.
Please proceed.
Well, look, I'd rather you be a Red Sox fan than not like baseball.
True, very true.
Anyway, but as a Yankees fan, one of my favorite presidential baseball stories is, of course, the George W. Bush visit to Yankee Stadium. So this is... You know, memories of the terrorist attacks on the World Trade Center are still raw. And, of course, a lot of the night was about politics. But it was about baseball, too. And this is what fascinates me, reading this in your book. It's about baseball and pride. Townhall.com released this great video of separate interviews with Bush as well as Yankee shortstop Derek Jeter. I want to play that now.
You know, I want to make sure that if I was going to throw out the ball, I was able to do so with a little zip. You know, I didn't want people to think that their president was incapable of finding the plate. So I go underneath the Yankee Stadium, in the bowels of Yankee Stadium, and there's a hitting cage there.
And then Derek Jeter comes up to him.
So I just asked him if he was going to be throwing the first pitch from the mound or in front of the mound. And I told him, you better throw it from the mound, otherwise you're going to get booed. I said, this is Yankee Stadium.
I said, okay, I'll throw from the mound. And he's walking out, and he looks over his shoulder, and he says, don't bounce it. They'll boo you. And so the pressure all of a sudden, I mean, I'm sitting there kind of fairly relaxed and feeling fairly loose, and the great Derek Jeter, don't bounce it. They'll boo you. And all of a sudden the pressure mounted.
The President of the United States.
Kurt, I love that story.
Well, that story is in the book. And I have the exchange between Jeter and Bush 43. In what Bush called the magnificent undercarriage of Yankee Stadium, a lovely term. And he followed the advice of Derek Jeter, which shows some good common sense there. And, you know, Jeter was right. I mean, the Yankee fans, like Red Sox fans and other clubs as well, have a great sophistication and knowledge about the history of the game. And the fact that, you know, if you're going to be a big league pitcher, you have to throw from the rubber. You can't using the old-time term, be a sissy and throw from in front of the mound. And having thrown a first pitch of my own, not at the big league level, I'm sure they would reject me, but for the AAA Rochester Red Wings, from the mound, I know how difficult it can be. I happened to throw a decent strike that day, but the wind probably carried it for me. And I didn't throw it with the velocity that Bush did. It was a stunning tour de force. And that night was something that the electricity that coursed through Yankee Stadium that night, because, of course, of what had happened the prior month, and the wounds that were still rubbed raw in New York, because this had been the epicenter, of course, of the terrorism. And the people that had been lost, and many personally that people at the ballpark knew. And, of course, what was interesting to me, I had not known this. I don't think many people do. Unbelievably, given how many World Series your team has been in and hosted at the big ballpark in the Bronx.
As they should.
This was the first American president ever to attend a World Series game at Yankee Stadium. Amazing. And Bush just rose to the occasion. That night, as I wrote in the presidents in the past time, he came closer to being a hero than he had ever been before or ever would be again. It was a stunning, gallant, noble performance.
You know, it's I wish there was a video of this interview, because I am so excited talking about these two subjects, because I have such passion for both politics and baseball. And I don't even know if I could answer this question that I'm about to ask you. But
oh, I think I know what it is, and I don't have an answer.
Well, do you prefer one over the other?
No. And I knew that was the question. I don't. How's that for decisiveness?
Yeah, you should. You'd be great in politics. John Kerry would be very proud of you.
This is an honest dodge, as opposed to their dishonest dodges. I don't know. I think if I had to give one up, including the reading of entirely about the subject, I would probably give up politics.
I think I would too.
Simply because the reading of baseball history to me is so part of my life. It's what I grew up on even before I read political history.
Kurt Smith is the author of a wonderful new book, The Presidents and the Pastime, The History of Baseball and the White House. Kurt, I can't begin to tell you what a pleasure it was having this conversation.
Thank you so much.
The crack of the bat, the stadium's roar. We were up on our feet for the tie-breaking score. I said, Daddy, I know what you brought me here for. He said, good, I hoped you'd hear the call. Life's a fastball, belt high, coming right down the middle. Don't stand there and let it go by. Swing hard and aim for the stands.
It's time to reveal the answer and winner of last week's trivia question, which was... In the past century, what sitting member of the House did the best running as a third candidate in the presidential general election? The answer? John Anderson. The Republican congressman from Illinois dropped out of the 1980 GOP contest that spring and ran as an independent against Carter and Reagan. He received 5.7 million votes, about 6.5% of the total. And the randomly selected winner is... Bob Manning of Kansas City, Missouri. Bob wins the coveted political junkie button. Don't forget, you can always find our political blogs, trivia questions, and the Political Junkie store, all at krpoliticaljunkie.com. It's time for This Week in Political History. It started off as a tale of personal tragedy. A mother, along with 13 other people, including her 5-year-old son, tried to escape Cuba in a 17-foot boat. It is Thanksgiving, 1999. Nearly all of them, including the mother, drown. The boy, Elian Gonzalez, somehow survives in an inner tube. He's taken ashore, and immigration officials temporarily release him to members of his extended family who live in Miami's Little Havana. Polls in this country showed clear majorities in favor of Elian being returned to his father, who decided to stay in Cuba. But at the same time, it riveted the nation's attention. In January, the INS said Gonzalez belongs with his father. Vice President Al Gore, in a January 2000 debate with fellow Democrat Bill Bradley, said this.
I think that the father should come here and stand on free soil to express the true feelings in his heart. I think we should remember and honor the fact that this child's mother lost her life, sacrificing her life in order to try to get her child freedom. Now, if Castro keeps hiring these paid demonstrators to shout outside the father's window, how can we be sure that he is not speaking under the threat of intimidation? If he is not allowed to come here and speak freely, then the matter should be addressed in our domestic relations courts that have expertise and experience and the body of law by which we traditionally answer those questions according to due process. As a father myself, I believe that we should focus on getting that father the right to say what is truly in his heart and then focus on what is truly best for the child.
After months of wrangling, of negotiations and demands, of political posturing, the status quo becomes untenable. On this week, 20 years ago, federal agents raided the extended family's home and snatched young Elian from the arms of his relatives with the purpose of reuniting him with his father.
Here comes the raid right now.
Against the barrier, now!
Oh, I'll be back! The whole world is watching this! You're traumatizing my boy!
Get back up against the barrier, now! You, go! Get out, now!
You guys watching, right? Let me go to the other side.
No,
let's go! Get over the barrier, Jake! Get over
And suddenly, an episode of personal tragedy becomes a political hot potato. Gore, by now the presumptive Democratic presidential nominee, had earlier broken from President Clinton to support a congressional bill that would take the matter out of the hands of the INS and give Gonzalez permanent residency. An honorable thing to do, or an obvious bit of pandering for the votes of Florida's Cuban Americans? I'm hoping Fernand Amande can answer that. He's the principal at the political and public affairs consulting firm Bendixson & Amande International. It's the go-to firm for understanding Hispanic attitudes about politics and culture. Fernand, welcome to The Political Junkie.
Ken, it's a pleasure to be here.
Well, thank you for being here, and I appreciate it. And so I guess I want to start with this question. Is it fair to say that although the case is heartbreaking, especially in the light of the fact that Elian's mother drowned while trying to get her son to safety, for the most part, the American people were in favor of reuniting him with his father in Cuba?
That's correct. Poll after poll at the time, leading up to the moment that Elian Gonzalez was sent back to his father, showed overwhelmingly the American public stated that he should be returned to his father, who was in Cuba. So that was certainly the mood at the time in the country.
What was the mood in the Cuban-American community in Florida?
Well, that was a very, very different dynamic, Ken. At the time, the Cuban community saw this as the ultimate microcosm of what had really been the entire struggle for the anti-Castro exile population over the years, as personified in this little boy whose mother, as you mentioned, sacrificed herself trying to get him to escape the Cuban regime and get him to freedom and opportunity here in the United States. And under no circumstances did they think it was not only appropriate, but morally allowable to let him go back to the communist regime in Cuba, whether or not it was his father or any other member of his family there. And that was really what created this tremendous polemic here in South Florida.
And it caught Al Gore up into the whole crisis and conflict. And what was Gore's argument in breaking from President Clinton?
Well, it was really just a perfect storm of problems for Al Gore at the time. And while his position certainly deviated from the administration and the Clinton administration's official position, it's hard not to see or feel that the calculus of politics might have played a role in that, Ken, because Gore and his team were no fools. They knew it was going to be a close election. Florida was then, is still today, the nation's most important swing state. And at the time, Florida's 27 electoral votes could have proven to have been pivotal in the race.
I would say we had no idea how pivotal Florida would be in 2000.
Well, certainly not at the time that Gore offered these positions, but events certainly proved him right on the money, as only a few months later, not only was the presidency decided in Florida based on the election, but it came down to those forever famous 500 and some odd votes that separated the presidency from Al Gore and George Bush. So it, I think, will not only prove to be one of those episodes in history that changed American history forever, you could really say in this case legitimately that the Elian Gonzalez situation probably was one of the critical factors that prevented Gore from winning the presidency.
Well, I mean, I remember at the time the newspaper editorials certainly weren't buying Gore's argument. The Los Angeles Times editorial page wrote, "Shame on Gore." The New York Times called it a, quote, "purely political maneuver designed to enhance his appeal in Florida." What were Florida voters saying at the time?
Well, Florida voters, for the most part, were aligned with where the rest of the country was in the idea that this little boy had a father who wanted to bring him back and take care of him as he had been doing prior to his mother taking him from Cuba to the United States. So voters in Florida, for the most part, shared that sentiment. It was when you got to South Florida, and in particular, the Cuban vote in the Cuban American community, where those positions were almost diametrically opposed. Problem politically, though, was that as Florida is always a very close state in presidential contest, how that Cuban vote participated in the election could very well have determined whether Florida was won or lost, and that is exactly what ended up happening.
Well, you know, I mean, there were so many reasons. There are a lot of things, of course, to point out to why Gore lost Florida. You know, I mean, people, of course, point to Ralph Nader. They point to the Democrats who voted for George W. Bush. But ultimately, as we've said, Florida is where the election was decided. And so you do think that even if the rest of the country didn't care about it, people cared about it in South Florida, and ultimately it may have played a big role in Gore's defeat.
I certainly think it did, and I'll tell you the reasons why. It's not just an opinion. I think it's an opinion forged in the data. If you look at what happened in 1996, Ken, Democratic candidates for president had always struggled in getting the Cuban-American vote, or at least winning it. Even to this day, I mean, it's hard to think back as to when the last time a Democrat actually won the Cuban vote. I certainly can't think of a time in my lifetime. But one of the things you did see was that in 1996, when Bill Clinton sought re-election, he had done a series of outreach and policy changes that a lot of members of the Cuban community felt were very good, very well done, whether it was the Helms-Burton Act after the shoot-down of the Brothers to the Rescue planes that the Cuban government shot down. Point is, he was able to get 35% of the Cuban American vote when he ran in November of 1996 against Bob Dole. Now, you might say, well, 35%, that's not a really good number. Well, it was, considering that in previous elections, Democratic candidates had only gotten 15% or 20% or 25%. So that was really seen as a high watermark. Fast forward 4 years later, Al Gore is this time on the ballot. He only ended up with 18% of the Cuban vote when Clinton had gotten 35% the year before. And it's, you can almost point exactly when it was that his numbers started to depress. It was right after Elian Gonzalez, because even though he took personally a position that a lot of Cuban Americans agreed with, they blamed the Clinton administration and the Democratic Party, and Al Gore suffered the consequences of that.
You know, Sergio Ben Dixon, your late partner who founded your firm and somebody I knew, was quoted as saying this. He says, "It was humiliating to Cuban Americans, and the 2000 election was payback."
Sergio, in his eternal wisdom, had it exactly right. For many Cubans, especially the older Cuban exiles who had spent a lifetime engaged in ideological combat with Fidel Castro, this was a moment of payback where all of the frustrations, the anguish of not ever being able to return back to their homeland in a free democracy, this was the moment where they were going to make the Democratic administration that Al Gore and Bill Clinton represented pay for having returned that boy, in their minds, the wrong decision, to his father back in communist Cuba.
Barack Obama carried Florida twice, but he worked to open up relations with the Cuban government. Trump reversed that. Where do Cuban-American voters stand vis-a-vis with President Trump right now?
Well, right now, one has to recognize that if there's probably any group of Hispanic voters in America where Trump does the best, it is indeed Cuban-American voters. The Trump administration has just bent over backwards trying to cultivate that group. And a lot of the gains, Ken, that you saw Democrats, especially Barack Obama and others, make over the years seem to have been reversed with the Trump campaign. That's a big question for whether or not Trump will be able to hold on to Florida now that the community and other voters across the state have seen the job Trump has done. But there is no doubt about the fact that today, President Trump still enjoys pretty strong numbers of the Cuban Americans, maybe not the Ronald Reagan or George Bush-level support that we saw in the 80s and in the 90s, but he's certainly still winning that vote.
And there's no question that Florida will once again be pivotal in deciding the next president.
I certainly think so. You know, there's some that can that say, well, you know, Florida's always close, but the Republicans always end up winning, and the Democrats probably shouldn't waste time, money, and resources here. But I just see it as an indispensable state. And as Barack Obama proved in 2008 and 2012, if you run a smart campaign, if you spend the time, if you do the outreach, you can win the state. And Florida is one of those backbreaker states, Ken, that if the Republicans don't have, it's almost impossible for them to win anywhere else.
Fernanda Amande is the principal at the political and public affairs consulting firm Ben Dixon and Amande International, based in Miami. You're also the host of the Strange Days podcast. What's that about?
Well, once we started to live in these unprecedented times, Ken, I began a podcast, and everybody wanted to talk about how strange the days and the times were. So I figured, what better title for a podcast than to try and explore this very strange period of American history where every day new things that we never thought possible happened and where the abnormal seems to become the normalized.
Well, lots of luck trying to explain that. Fernanda, it was great having you on the program.
It's a pleasure, Ken. Thank you so much.
It was 20 years ago this week, on April 22nd, 2000, when armed federal agents broke into a home in Miami and took Elian Gonzalez away to be handed over to his father and returned to Cuba. You're listening to This Week in Political History on The Political Junkie.
Elian Gonzalez. His mother tried to win, no Elian Gonzalez, Elian Gonzalez. He left in a boat, his mother tried to win, no dead. Elian Gonzalez, Elian Gonzalez. Had a gun to his head, but they didn't shoot him dead, no longer living in my head. Elian Gonzalez, Elian Gonzalez. Had a gun to his head, but they didn't shoot him dead, no longer living in my head.
That's it for this week's show. Be sure to check out our website for much more political content and to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. It's all at krpoliticaljunkie.com. If you've got comments, questions, or complaints, send an email to ken at krpoliticaljunkie.com. You can also tweet us at Ken Rudin and at Ken Rudin Junkie, or follow the show on Facebook. And you can follow my button of the day on Instagram at The Political Junkie. Political Junkie is distributed by PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. The show is produced by Devin Maverick Robbins, and Douglas Bell is our coordinating producer. I'm Ken Rudin. Thanks for listening. See you next week. And as always, stay safe.
Elian Gonzalez, Elian Gonzalez. Legend for his mother trying to win, no standing there. Elian Gonzalez, Elian Gonzalez. He left in a boat, his mother turned away, now he's living dead. Elian Gonzalez, Elian Gonzalez. Had a gun to his head, but they didn't shoot him dead, no longer living in my head. Elian Gonzalez, Elian Gonzalez. Had a gun to his head, but they didn't shoot him dead, no longer living in my head.